So, this is Brianna Wiggins with your Stories Remembered Oral History Project. We are in Sewanee, Tennessee with Everett Lee McCrary and Hulbert Henrique James Jr. Is it right to say your preferred name is Kwesi?
Yes.
Preferred name Kwesi. We are on, the date is February 25th, 2013, and we are on the upstairs level of McGriff Alumni House. Hopefully that isn't like bass boosted on the recording.
I see.
All right.
Well, thank you for having us and receiving us. We're open arms to record what our memories are here at the University of the South, better known as Sewanee. I'm of the class, my name's again Everett McCrary, and I'm in the class of 1986. I'm originally from Atlanta, Georgia, and went to an Atlanta public high school and matriculated through Sewanee, which we had an opportunity to enjoy a whole bunch of array of things. And that being an introduction, I guess you want to introduce yourself as well, and then we'll go into some kind of dialogue.
Sure. So, yes, again, my name is Hulbert James Jr., preferred name Kwesi. I came in the second class that Eric Benjamin recruited. I came in 1982. I also went to the same high school that Everett McCrary went to. We both are graduates of George High School. He graduated in 1981, I graduated in 1982 in Atlanta, Georgia.
Awesome. Okay. Yeah.
Buddies for a long time.
we went to high school and college together. And maintain a friendship over these last, 40 years or so, not better. Obviously not in contact all the time, but we know how it is when you reconnect with a friend. Things are like no distance has passed by. So, you know, we respect each other individually, our choices in life, and eternally, I think we love each other. At least I do with the love of Christ Jesus. Amen. So, we're here to share stories. I guess one of the first stories that I could share is the first day of arriving here at the University of the South. My friend, who was also a graduate and a graduate of Atlanta Public High School, Mr. Eric Walden, who's not here with us today, I'm sure he'll do this at some point. We both came to a conclusion that this was, Sewanee would be the place that we would go to school. We didn't come to it in a collective manner, but we came to that conclusion in our own events in life. So I'm probably going to start how I got that and then come back to the first day of school. So Eric Benjamin, prior to becoming the Minority Student Affairs Director, was a legal aid attorney, as I understand it, in the Atlanta area. But he was a graduate of Sewanee. And so Sewanee was trying to launch a program that would bring more African-American students to campus. They had students, obviously, but the presence wouldn't be as what it is now currently. And so he came to our high school, and they made a presentation with a Mr. Gooch. I never forget that day. So we have to see Mr. Benjamin at the time and in his youth. He looked similar to what he did now. And a very tall gentleman, afro, beard, gray, slights of gray, not as much as he has now. And then just sitting there, and then the other gentleman who was the active, I think, admissions director or counselor recruiter, Mr. Gooch, came to our high school, and our counselor invited all the people who were in the top 10% of our class there. And so we were sitting at a table like we are currently, a round table, and the presentation was made. And I looked at the photographs, and you look at Sewanee, and oh man, this is a beautiful campus. Such a nice, and I have this affinity for outdoors anyway. In fact, I claim to be one of the students who saw all 10,000 acres, because I did a lot of hiking when I was here, personal hiking. But anyway, During that event, Mr. Gutmacher made a presentation, and then at that presentation, the amount that it would cost to go here became a issue, or it became magnified. A number of my high school classmates looked at it and said, oh man, sounds great, how much did it cost? When that answer came up, I was like, wow, okay, well, we can't afford that. And then that kind of knocked out some of the possibilities in some of my classmates. It was about 15 of us. Mine. And then Benjamin stood up and he said, well, what Mr. Gooch is not telling you is that if you want to come, if you're accepted and you want to come, there's financial means available. So that opened my mind up. And then Swanee, having the number of students, small classes, that was very attractive to me. I investigated further and then came to a conclusion that this is a real possibility. So I applied and was accepted. At the same time, I had opportunities for a Division I and Division II football scholarship. Yeah, and actually earned a full football scholarship at MTSU here in Murfreesboro. And so I was torn between football and Swanee at the time. So I made a trip about 3 weeks before school started here, because practice and football starts about 3 weeks before school. Traveled to Murfreesboro and literally practiced with MTSU's football team. My mother encouraged me to do that simply because it was a full ride, we wouldn't pay anything, that kind of thing. But when I got there and I found out that football on a higher collegiate level probably wouldn't allow me to be a student. That was my conclusion because of the number of practices we had and the concept by which they treated players. I saw one of my players, one of the guys on my team, who was in my position, turned and crashed and burned, so to speak, tore his leg. They drug him off the field, and the position coach said, drag him off the field. A guy named John, you're next. Everett, you're fourth on the depth chart. And I was like, wow, just that clean and clear cut. And so that resonated with me as to how much of a non-student I would probably be able to be. Mm-hmm. And then at some point after a week there practicing, I just decided that I didn't think collegiate football at that level would be for me. Mm-hmm. And so I returned home, and then the following week, Eric Walter and myself followed each other up to Swanee and arrived here on campus with our automobiles loaded with stuff, and arrived right in front of our dorm, which we had been assigned to be roommates, Gaylor Hall, which you know, it doesn't look the same now. It was a dining hall at that time.
A dining hall and dormitory.
And dormitory. Yeah, and it operated with steam pipes. That was always a memory, right? So to get heat, the steam pipes would come on in the wintertime, and it sounded like someone was beating the pipe. Clang, clang, clang. And that's when the steam, get the heat to the room would come. So we were met that summer with Eric Benjamin. We drug our personal effects to our room, tried to establish some sense of home comfort. And Benjamin was just so excited to see us, and we were excited to be here. Upon arrival, we met two other students who were already enrolled, Miss Betty Arnold and a Cleavis Headley. They were, I think, sophomores at the time. And we befriended them, and we moved forward in such a manner. And by the way, I should say this is important too, because at the time, Swanee had what we call Saturday classes. I don't know if you've ever heard of this.
Sounds horrible.
Yeah, it is.
Before you go to Saturday class, why don't you tell about the other two students that came with you and Ed?
Okay, your class. That's fair enough. Okay, so the other two students who came to Swanee at the time, myself and Eric Walden, were also, well, one was another person from the Atlanta Public School System, Ms. Eugenia Williams, and she went to Farrell High School, which was a local high school that we were familiar with. And then also Ms. Sarina Satcher, and I think Ms. Sarina hailed from Nashville, but her dad was a instructor at a college in, I want to say, Carolina, I think, or Virginia. No, I'm sorry, it was Virginia. And
it's
yeah, no, it was Virginia. And And so at the time, there were four African-American students who arrived here, who joined in union with two others, and we had a total of six minority students on Eric Benjamin's inaugural development of the Black Student Union at that point, of the Minority Student Affairs Office, which is now transitioned to something else. At that point, we went to class every day and made our way through our first year, like any other you all do as well. One of the things I thought that was interesting, and you and I had this conversation last night, that when we were dining in the dining hall, we would sit together, and the rest of the population, or our student population, would always say, well, why do all the Black students sit together all the time?
That's a book title, actually.
Is it really?
Yeah, it's like, why do all the Black students sit together? It's an actual
book. Well, you have a little bit of your analysis. I think it's good. I can tell now, but you tell your part of the analysis of that. I like
where
you put it.
And I'm thinking we'll probably do this interview because I'm listening to how much in depth you're going to do. You're going into. I'm thinking maybe you probably should. We'll center this interview around you. Mm-hmm. I'll chime in. Then I'll center one around me.
Right.
And if he's still around, you can chime in.
That'll be perfect.
I think that's good. Just in terms of the Black student, I just said that, usually people sit together based on their interests and common goals and blah, blah, blah. I mean, we know that the football players sat with each other, the basketball players sat with each other, the different fraternities and sororities, they sat with each other on, and so people from different dorms sat with each other. So that's just...
It was just kind of
people just, what people do, people sit together based on their common interests or connections with each other.
Right. So I like the way you put that. Okay. It's actually very factual and accurate, but I always found it to be interesting that people would ask that question. And my take on it is that, okay, well, if it's an issue, nobody didn't banish anyone from coming sitting with us. I just thought that, hey, if you felt like you wanted to come and sit, it was a free environment. You're welcome to come and sit, that kind of thing. So at that time, coming to the university, when you talk about African-American students, you talk about the universalities of things that they have in common with all cultures. And some of the things that we have in common with all cultures is the idea of music, song, and art. Mm-hmm. That plays a role in every culture in the world that has ever existed. And so we found an environment by which there was music and culture, but it wasn't totally a music and culture that was identifiable to us, although there, to the university's advantage or the fraternity house advantage, they would, on party weekends, have bands that played our style of music, which we liked. So I'm, myself being a music aficionado, so to speak, love music. I brought with me my little stereo system at the time, and all my quote-unquote album collections that I had at that time, which grew over time. And we just began to enjoy the music and enjoy each other, and then at some point, the need to be, I guess, carve out an identity that fit who we were culturally began to arise. Okay, the Firehouse is having this band and that fraternity is having that band. Okay, so what's identifiable about us and how can we operate in that space? So the following year, my sophomore year, I went home that summer and worked and earned some money, and I was determined to buy me a upgraded stereo system with a nice turntable and all. And I did that, earned enough money to do that. And buy books and brought it back to school with me, and hence a cultural thing took off. We began to have social events at what you all call your, what do you call that place down there? It's like we used to call it, was known as the Outside In.
The Ayers Multicultural
Center. Ayers Multicultural Center.
MCC.
That's what you all call it. Back in the day, it was called the Outside In, and it was just basically a facility that was empty that you could schedule events, sign up for schedule events. And so we found ourselves signing up and scheduling events and having parties. When party weekend came, we wanted a party that, you know, people could have fun and go dancing and have fun, that kind of thing. And that's what we did. And
go ahead. I was just going to say, and to my recollection, didn't really anybody else use it. I mean, it was available for use, but no one else on campus was using it. It just
became, it was like a band.
And probably the more we used it, the less likely anybody else was considered using it.
That's very familiar sounding.
Exactly. It was pretty much abandoned, wasn't it? Yeah, so and we adopted. I recall Eric, who's a fledgling artist in and of himself. He played the piano for his church, and also he just played piano. Just to play piano, have fun. He was considered himself a music songwriter, that kind of thing. And we had an event at the outside end with him and another student. I can't remember his name. He played the guitar, and Eric played the piano. Mm-hmm. He was a Caucasian student. I want to put a light on that because these were unions, although I don't remember the guy's name. He was a great fellow. And he had a concert at the outside end. And he played some of his own songs. He played some songs that he knew. And I did the lighting for him. And I recall him and the young gentleman, they played a song by, Sunshine on My Shoulder Makes Me Happy. John Denver. John Denver. And me doing the light. And I heard the opening entry of the song. This is a very funny thing. And so I'm doing the lights. And so when they get to the opening line, sunshine on my shoulder makes me happy, I turned on a light that shined on his shoulder. And everybody laughed. I thought it was funny. That concert was such a success for Eric that he got an article in the Purple. They call him the future Lionel Richie. Isn't that something? Yeah. So over time, you know, we bonded as a group of students. The push for faculty, I don't know if Dr. Dunn was here yet, but he came sometime, either a little bit later, and he taught political science, and then we had Benjamin. And so, in addition to those social events, we would have regular parties, or not necessarily parties, but dinners, and just a welcome session or party at Benjamin's house. Michelle Benjamin would cook dinner for us, and mm-hmm. she'd invite us over, and we'd listen to music and just talk, just a gathering, you know, mm-hmm. social, so we wouldn't feel too far lost from home. Being sometime in Swanee, you can feel isolated because of where we are, because of the climate, all that kind of thing. And fortunately, we had an automobile. We had access to automobiles, and we had some fellow high school students who went to the University of Chattanooga, University of UT Chattanooga, UTC. And we would travel down and go see them on weekends when they had activities going, and we would join them. So that was a very, very a positive thing that helped us cope with being socialized in a college environment. Because, you know, you come to college, you want to have a little fun, you want to study hard, you want to play hard, you want to enjoy the full aspect of your college experience. And so sometimes the university campus just wouldn't offer that. And so we sought it out in other universities nearby. Mm-hmm. We had relationships. Sarah Satcher's father subsequently got a position at Fisk University, mm-hmm. where he was an instructor. And so we would go to her house. We'd go to Fisk University. So we bonded with some students at Fisk University. We had student bonding with those at the UTC in Chattanooga. And so we came up with outlets. And then not only that, because of this community, back when we got here, the African-American community was a little bit more vibrant than what it is currently. So we had people who were our age living in this community, and we befriended them, and it was intentional on my part that we would befriend them, and because of that, I think a relationship developed to where we would invite them to any activity that we would have going on. We wanted them to be a part of us. Well, let me put that in context too, because as we know, SWANEE is an elitist and elite university, and people who from elite families send their children here to get educated. So their financial position would be much greater than what anything that we would be able to bring to the table. And in fact, sometimes it could be a little bit daunting to see your classmates who are freshmen driving around in BMWs and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, but that didn't necessarily bother me that much. The thing that got next to me, though, is the fact that we could either alienate ourselves from that, from this existing Black community, or we could join it. Now, in my mind, these people who worked for the university, and they worked off campus as well, but they were here. And I saw them as connected to my family back home. And why did I see that? Because they were from working class families, their fathers, their parents, their mothers. They went to work every day. They worked at high schools. They worked here at the university. They worked at UTC, Arnold Engineering Air Force Base. So they worked at these places. They had to go and work a day a week. And my parent, my dad, my mom, they did the same thing. So I could easily identify with working class people. And I think I could say for truth that nearly for at least the next 5 years, I don't know what the socioeconomic status of students are now, but when we were here, all of them came from either working class or working middle class families, or maybe even at the edge of upper middle class families. Mm-hmm. Nobody was obviously well off enough to pay their way through school.
Of the Black students?
Yes, of the Black students at school. I'm glad you clarified that. So it was just a natural progression to befriend these people. I mean, we work with them. That sometimes our student work situations put us next to them, right next to them, working in the same thing as our work study program. So that was cool. And so I saw those connections, and I made it it was my intent to make that one of the things that we would do, because we could come here and become isolated in terms of our mentality, but that wasn't anything I thought would be productive for us as a community, considering the fact that we were actually coming to their hometown. They weren't coming to ours, and so for us to welcome them to their hometown seemed kind of odd, but I was thankful that we develop relationships that allow them to be welcoming to us. And they, when we go to their homes, they invite us to dinner, they came to our events, symposiums, they came to music events, and it made them feel more welcome, made them feel a part of us. And I think we bonded with this community, this African American community, very, very well, so to speak. I could say that without a doubt. Yeah, I don't know if you want to add anything to that at all, but you're welcome to.
Well, you're saying we, and I appreciate the general we. I think you really, really strongly bonded with the community. Not that, I mean, not that we didn't, but you, I think, were the person who really epitomized our connection to the community, to the Black community in Swanee.
I didn't realize I had that much weight, but I recall some of the other students having personal relationships.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I worked in Gaylor Hall with other, with some of the Black community here, as part of my work study, So, yeah.
Yeah, sure. So, that's pretty much our first year. After buying that stereo system, and we found ourselves becoming somewhat of a fledgling DJ group. That developed into something else.
Take the fledgling.
There you go. We did it, right? So because of the name that we gave ourselves, I want Quasi to actually address this, because his memory is a little bit clear about how the name was established. And then I'll chime in as well.
Go ahead. Do that. Because I think we have it clear.
Well, my version of the story is, this is Quasi speaking, is that as Everett just said, we started, he had come back from the summer and had bought DJ equipment, and I want to add to that, we also found out, one of the things, I'll get into my story more, is that we were very resourceful as it relates to Swan. Yeah, we always tried to figure out how to get the most out of what we could. And in that sense, we found that there was this huge, like, black speaker.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we used to rent this, we used to check that speaker out from the library all the time as a part of our DJ equipment. But how the name came into being, from my memory, is that Mr. Benjamin gave us a name one time, put some name on a flyer. And I was trying to say it in a nice way. We weren't too fond of his creative name that he gave us. So we said, out of self-determination, we need to come up with our own name as DJs, especially since we're going to probably be doing this more and people don't want blah, blah, blah DJ to come and DJ at their party. So we need to have a name to go along with us, not just call Everett and hope to come DJ. Right? Yeah. So anyway, so I remember.
Don't forget Eric and Carrie as well. Yeah. But they were coming.
Eric Walden, Everett's roommate at that time, was also a part of it, and as well as Carrie Sinclair came later, and who you mentioned earlier, Cleveland's head, he was already here. So the five of us formed this brotherhood, which we called Montu. And Montu, the way I remember it happening was that we were sitting around in the room thinking about a name, and I literally saw in my mind's eye this book on my mother's shelf, and it was called Montu. And so I just blurted out Montu. Didn't even remember what it mean or knew what it mean. I just blurted out Montu. And everybody looked like, yeah, they liked the sound of it. And Everett added connection. And so NC's, Montu Connection. And so later on, I found that book, looked it up, and the book, the word Montu is from Southern Africa. And it basically means humanity, or the essence of humanity, the spirit that unites people as human beings. So that's what Montu means. And so we began to consider ourselves to actually embody that as like a brotherhood. And I'll talk more about that, but that's my story.
I agree with that. And so as young men, especially in all culture, again, super cultural events, rites of passage become a thing of importance. So in the university environment, the rite of passage that helped bring young men to manhood or youth to manhood is called a rite of passage. And one of those things that helped do that is fraternities. So obviously, Swan had their fraternities, but we couldn't find an identity for us in that fraternity. Hence, Montu became that identity of rite of passage for African American, for us as African American men, and brotherhood and bonding. And so we did quite a few things, and so we even had some shirts printed that have, and this is in your book, in it, yeah, that have Montu written on it red with our sleeves. And we had a lot of, and we weren't just a DJ group. We fancied ourselves to be a total part of this community in all facets, actually. And so Montu, I know that you all have literal Greek fraternities now, but one of the things as part of our identity was that, okay, we're a little bit more progressive than the Greek system. At least that's the way I recall it. And if we were to go see if we could get somebody to sponsor a chapter of, let's say, a known African-American fraternity, then we're still adopting a Western Greek identity, but just black folk, that was our concept. So Montu fit perfectly. It was African. It represented who we were as people. And it gave us a way of carving out a social identity here in Swanee that fit us well. That, along with the minority, or the BSU, as we call it, the Black Student Union, because we were both a part. These organizations, the Black Student Union was there. And it, as Montu developed, it emerged into a concept and actually into a whole idea, and I want to say movement to some degree.
we became a sort of a progressive end of a BSU, so to speak. Members of both.
We brought the BSU into existence. That's a whole story. I'll tell you. Yeah.
Well, I'll let you tell that.
It wasn't the BSU when we came here.
Okay, well, good. All right, so, yeah, so that Ubuntu became our fraternity album. And so we identified, the campus began to identify us like that. And like I said, we just didn't do DJs. We did a whole bunch of stuff. As I recall, in 1984, it was 83, Suwannee was hit with a major ice storm. Mm. And all classes had been canceled for the first time in Suwannee history. Mm. Half of our student population fled to Florida. Those who could afford it, obviously we couldn't afford it. And we were
probably more than that.
Yeah, and then whoever were remaining, we were left here to survive that ice storm. So let me give you an example of how Muntu responded to this. So we didn't necessarily just sit back. So we came up with some badges and wrote, what is it, Muntu Rescue Squad or something to that effect on it. And what we did was, at that time, Lake Chestnut, was it Lake Chestnut? Yeah, it was frozen to solid. You could walk on the ice over there. We did that. But then we thought about our fellow students, especially the women at the girls' dorm. And so it was our intent to go around and make sure that all of the girl dormitories had at least a fire, because all of them had fireplaces, to make sure they at least had wood in their fireplace and a fire starter so they could keep themselves warm. And so we did that to all the female dormitories. We figured the guys could handle themselves. We searched out among the campus to find all the facilities, all the buildings that had electricity. Mm-hmm. And at that time, the Bishop's Common was one of those buildings that had electricity. Mm-hmm. And so we just let people know, hey, look, there's electricity in this building, there's electricity. So if you want to get together, you can, you know, kind of keep yourself warm and be active. So that night, or during that period of time, the Bishop's Common, I don't know what you all use it for now, but the back part of where the offices are were pretty much open. Even where Eric Benjamin's office is currently, where his former office is, he's no longer there, but his office was, that was all open space. And so somehow we came up with a space heater, and we took blankets off our bed, and all of us went and plugged the space heater up and slept on the floor in the Bishop's Common in that particular area, just so we could stay warm, so we could have the comfort of each other, so we can be supportive to anybody who may have felt, you know, a little afraid in regard of the incident. And then about maybe 4 days later, actually, the National Guard was sent to Suwannee just to open it back up, to cut these trees down. There were big trees that had been fallen, and then cover the roads. And, you know, some of our student population were in panic mode. But myself, I can point to a point in my history when I was a child in Atlanta. A tornado hit inner city Atlanta.
Before you go,
yeah.
So this is crazy. I actually have pictures from that storm of us standing on Lake Chestnut in the middle of the lake, us posing by trees that were totally snapped in half. Mm-hmm.
Big trees.
And, yeah, huge trees that were totally snapped in half. And we have pictures of just around campus of just the ice storm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it gets ridiculous up here. I know we didn't have like an ice storm. It was just like, oh, it's snow came through, and then looking at the trees, like they were the branches encased in ice, and mm-hmm. the ice needles encased in ice. And then everyone was like, be careful because the branches would fall and shatter. Mm-hmm. And like, if that fell on somebody, that'd be it.
You're right. So imagine that, because that quadrangle out there, or that area, used to have huge, I mean, it's got some huge trees down, but there were more of them. And that actually happened. I mean, nobody got hurt, but those limbs would fall, break, and like I said, they were covering the road, the street, University Avenue. And so when they were falling in front of girls' dormitories, and, you know, we went into those dormitories and just found young women who really were sort of frantic at the time. And so we just wanted to make sure we could comfort them in some manner. And we thought the manner by which we could comfort them was to make sure their fireplace was burning and that they had heat.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so that was cool. I'm sure Hope's going to speak a little bit more about mine, too. We did a number of things in the community. We participated well. We We did some fundraisers around campus. We're proactive. We raised our own money and bought a foosball. You remember that? A foosball table that we put in a bishop's cup for everybody to use because we wanted to play, like, they don't want to play pool. Like, oh, they don't got pool. Well, why don't we do something about it? So we raised our own money and bought a foosball table. And we had fun doing those kinds of things. This organization also, through Cletus Headley, had, it was intellectual as well, because he developed a, what we call the student-faculty dialogue. This was an organization started by himself, and I want to say the young lady who were in the philosophy department. He was a philosophy major, and one of his philosophy majors, students, and they thought and said, hey, look, maybe there needs to be some kind of dialogue between the faculty and students. And so they began to do this thing called, establish this organization called the Student Faculty Dialogue. And so we would meet probably once a month in Bishop's Common in the area, in the open area, lounge area, and have lecture presentations where students can respond to faculty. Faculty can make presentations. Students can make presentations. So it was a back and forth intellectual feed between students. And so it was his brainchild, when he and the other students' brainchild. And man, it just goes to show that Muntu was just not all about entertainment, but we were about the holistic aspect of us being a part of the Suwannee community. I want to revert back to something that I missed with regard to academics, because I thought when I started thinking about academics in the sense, because you know Suwannee is very challenging academically. Coming from the Atlanta public school system, we read probably one, two Shakespeare plays, maybe one, exposed to Shakespeare to a minimum level. Mm-hmm. But when you got to Suwannee and you had to write papers on Shakespeare plays that you read, and you're reading them and the language wasn't necessarily resonating. And so there had to be a way of overcoming this obstacle. So the library had a music listening room, and I used to work there, and I subsequently found out that they had Shakespeare plays on recording, on albums. So now I was like, okay, I'm having a hard time learning this language, seeing how this language, how am I gonna write a paper if I can't understand what they're talking about, the context by which it was going on. And so I went to the music listening room, checked out the album. You could play, put your headphones on, go in the room, and they play it. And took my English book and read along with it, and those Shakespeare plays came to life for me at that point, which allowed me to be a somewhat better student in English. I said somewhat better student. Helped me pass the class. So the academic environment, we never had any remedial classes or anything like that. There was not a remedial program. So, again, you had to be resourceful. And I think, again, what Quasi said about us being resourceful. We didn't wait on anybody to hand us something. We would say, okay, here's what we need. What can we do as our part to make something happen that will make it better for us? And I think that's it. That's what took place. Now, I'm going to stop there because I've used a lot of time, and I'm sure you got some things that you want to talk about, and I'll chime in again like you did.
Well, y'all got notes on topics, I want to say for the record. Quakes has been on this 8.5 by 11 paper, got it filled up.
So should we stop it and start it back, or just keep it going?
You want to be that separate from me?
Well, it's 10:54 now.
I'm good.
So,
all
right.
I'm good.
Okay, we'll just keep it going like this.
Go on. What you gonna start with?
Man, I don't know.
Y'all never did elaborate on Saturday school.
Oh, so, I guess I can do that. Okay, so let me just do it real quick.
okay, so when I was a freshman, we had Saturday classes. Mm-hmm. So we would have a day off in the middle of the week, and then we have class on Saturday, mm-hmm. which was very counterproductive because after a Friday night at Swine, and I'll leave that into your imagination, you know what that's like, and then having to come to class on Saturday, the professors thought it was unproductive. We as students found it to be unproductive. And then after my freshman year, they terminated that, coming to a very informed conclusion that it was counterproductive. Mm-hmm. And so I'm glad they did that. Although one of the things that I think it did do was identify Swan as being unique to have Saturday classes. But mm-hmm. I assume that uniqueness being unique wasn't enough to justify keeping it. I put it that way. I think that's the best way to put that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not one of the better ideas.
Yeah. Everybody wants to relax on the weekend, you know. Mm-hmm.
So which of the many topics? You can see lots going through Quincy's mind right now.
Yeah, I was just thinking, as I kind of also maybe just started, you know, in terms of coming to Suwanee, you know, again, coming from Atlanta, a predominantly black city, predominantly black high school, you know, and in addition to that, I was raised in African culture and tradition. I'm doing this interview in full African clothing. Even the name Kwesi, I have several African names that have been given to me, and that's how most people know me, even my family. And so coming to Suwanee was quite a challenge for me on different levels. You know, it's so interesting to me because I had a full scholarship to Morehouse, and a preeminent black college for black men in Atlanta. I had a full scholarship to Howard University. And that's the one I still say I kind of regret not taking up both of those, but I'm sure my life would have taken a different course then, obviously. So it was a reason why I came to Suwanee. I often tell people my elders kind of guided me to go to Suwanee because it's like, okay, well, we know you got the black thing down, so you don't need to go to a HBCU. You know, can you navigate the world? And Suwanee would be a good test for you to see that. So that was kind of how I ended up coming to Suwanee. I remember everyone was talking about his visit. You know, again, I mentioned wearing African clothes. I was wearing African clothes in high school at that time, and I didn't even own a shirt or tie. A button-up shirt that you wear, or a tie, a blazer. Mm-hmm. And so when I came to visit Suwanee, before I came to visit Suwanee, I asked Eric Benjamin about that. He said, oh, that's just tradition. It's not required. Don't worry about that. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know about now, but it was required when we came. and I heard it's not required now.
Not really, no. Classic dress is more of a ideal, I guess, in a way.
I don't know when that happened, so but it's not a requirement. That's a couple people told me that as well. But it was a definite requirement then. So I came to visit Suwanee, and like Ever said, yeah, it was very impressive, the nature, the buildings, architecture, structure. And so part of my visit was that was to go sit in a class. So I'm getting ready to go to a class, and it's like, oh, you know, you can't go like that. You got to have a shirt and ties. So I borrow a tie from shirt from Everett or Cleavis, I think it was. I'm not sure. So I could go and sit in class because I didn't have the quote-unquote Suwanee attire for class. I'm like, gosh, I got to go back home this summer and buy shirts and ties and blazers and penny loafers. I changed my whole wardrobe. This is kind of interesting, like, you know, I could have picked a school, but not necessarily one that had that as a criteria. Right? I went to another PWI. But anyway, Suwanee was the choice. So, and also I just want to, I was trying to think of a way to kind of frame my conversation on just like an overall thing. And I think one of the ones, like I said, I want to bring out is the resourcefulness that we had. But also I think, you know, and Evan and I were talking about this, how we came to have to deal with Suwanee on our own terms. And, you know, I think that, and I hear that it's still true today with some of the African-American students, is that usually students that come from predominantly black cities, predominantly black high schools, that's what they do. They figure out how to have their own, make sense of Sewanee for themselves and not necessarily try to assimilate into Sewanee.
Right.
Whereas students that come from predominantly white, or maybe it's rural areas or cities, or don't necessarily have that foundation, mm-hmm. oftentimes find themselves, in our opinion, wanting to fit in, blend in, assimilate into Sewanee. So I think with every group of black students that are here, you have those two different groups. So we were definitely the, we're not trying to assimilate crew, as you've heard Everett lay out. And so but I think one of the things also, I was just thinking about some things that was that we haven't talked about. You know, I think it's important that, you know, Everett talked about that, you know, not only did we have to carve out a space for ourselves so we could have our own healing, but also we wanted to make a contribution to Sewanee. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we did was our cultural awareness symposium. I think I began those. And the first year, if I'm correct, we brought in Dr. Manning Merrill, who's a leading black, he's no longer alive, but he was a leading black, one of the leading black economists, political economists in the United States.
He taught at FIST
at the time, right? So we brought him in, this the keynote speaker, and we brought an African dance ensemble that I was a part of in Atlanta to come and perform. And I keep saying this because I want this to get documented. I got pictures of me dancing on stage in Sewanee, pictures of Everett and Cleavis and the African dance ensemble performing here at our campus. And that was, again, that was so uplifting for me to bring the African dance ensemble that I was a part of as a high school student to perform at Sewanee, to see that side of me, for me to express my culture, my tradition, and to dance on stage. I even remember my French teacher, he spoke to me after that. He was just so surprised to see that side, because in French class, I was very quiet, and, you know, he spoke in French, and so I struggled in French, and not make eye contact with the professor, you don't want him to call on you, that kind of thing. So I was very, very shy, so he got to see another side of me. After seeing that performance. So the first year we brought Dr. Manny Maribel and Atlanta African Dance Ensemble. The second year we brought Dr. Leonard Jeffries and Life Force Jazz Band, which is a jazz band I was familiar with in Atlanta as well. Dr. Leonard Jeffries, to me, is one of the preeminent historians on the planet, black historian. And so he came to Sewanee and just killed it, smashed it, all of that. Dr. Leonard Jeffries is just a world-renowned historian. He went to the Sorbonne. So as a part of his presentation, he started speaking in French. And he let people know that he had the academic pedigree to be at Sewanee and to be anywhere, because he had gone to the Sorbonne. And he lays out all of this history about how, you know, Africans are the foundation for what we call Greek culture, that Herodotus and Pythagoras and all of these, Plato and Aristotle, all these so-called great Greek thinkers and mathematicians and philosophers studied in Kemet, got their teachings from Kemet. And I recently shared this with Everett. I shared this with a few people, and he pulled out something called the Peter's Projection, which is a whole different map of the world than the map that we normally see in terms of the sizes of mm-hmm. Africa versus the size of Europe, the size of North and South America. He pulled that out and showed that. And he's very, what's I want to say? You know, he was very expressive and charismatic in his presentation. He's laying out all of his facts and just upending Western culture, upending Western civilization. And in Sewanee, so this was the icing on the cake. At the very end of his speech, he finishes, and he says, are there any questions or comments? So I just know some white professor is going to challenge him, one of the professors in history, Harvard trained here at Sewanee. Mm-hmm. Nobody said anything. Mm-hmm. That was one of the proudest moments to be a black person I've had experience. Dr. Leonard Jeffries at Sewanee.
Praise God.
Nobody challenged him, didn't even ask a question. The third year we wanted to focus on women.
Right.
And so we brought, I don't have her name, but again, also I do, again, I keep saying I'm doing this for the record. So I do have a flyer from that, we called them cultural awareness symposiums. and it has Dr. Leonard Jeffries' presentation on it and the Life Force Jazz Band on there. And then the third one we did, we decided to focus on women. And we brought us a woman in who I believe was from India.
Yeah,
and she was a professor at Yale.
The way that happened is I had done a summer intern in Atlanta with the American Friends Association, which is a church-based
Quaker-based
organization for civil rights struggle and part of civil rights movement. Also, I must put for the record that I also did an intern with the Martin Luther King Center for Nonviolent Social Change in the summer of 1984, where I had an opportunity, it was called a King Scholars intern, and I had an opportunity to meet, I already knew these people, but I had an opportunity to meet and get personal with John Lewis, everybody knows John Lewis. And he was a member of the district in my house, of my area in Atlanta, my voting district. So we ate dinner at John Lewis's house. C.T. Vivian, one of the pioneers of the civil rights movement, you can probably see him in some film footage where he's on the steps of a church in Alabama in Birmingham, and the police attack, and he defends this, and they break his nose, and he bleeds.
The icon of the civil rights movement.
Exactly. And then at the end, we actually participated in social... it's called Nonviolent Social Change. And so we had different assignments as scholars, student interns, there were about 10 of us. And we had different assignments in Atlanta, and one of my assignments was adult education as well. And at the end of the intern, we saw Ms. Coretta Scott King on a daily basis. But at the end of the internship, we all got an opportunity to sit down like we are now and have a conversation with Coretta Scott King face-to-face, one-on-one, ask her anything you wanted. And man, that was priceless in my mind. And then not only that, at the time she had written a book called My Life with Martin, and she gave us a personal autographed copy of her book. And I still have that book today at home, well-preserved and well-taken care of, along with some other memorabilia from the Martin Luther King Center for Nonviolent Social Change. I like to say a little bit more about that, but I want to be respectful to Kwesi because it is his turn.
That's fine. And actually, I want to come back to that because, again, that was one of the examples of us being resourceful. I had found out about the I don't remember the name of it. I don't know, was it the Tanya
Foundation.
The Tanya Scholarship, I think it was called, where Swanee students can do a internship. And Swanee would pay for it. And so when I found out about that, I did an internship and I started sharing with other African-American students, and many of us took advantage of that to do an internship. We mentioned Eric several times on this presentation. Eric Walden, he did an internship as well. Like I said, I did two internships. I'll come back to that. I didn't want to jump around too much. But again, that was another example of the resourcefulness of us, finding out as many things as we can to enrich our Swanee experience and make it work for us. So we brought in Dr. Asoke to be the keynote speaker, but then what we did, and this was the year we got creative, because we found out that a student organization could request that the food service, that lunch could be served at a location we choose. So you want to tell that story? Go ahead.
No, I'm just saying, but that was my brainchild.
Okay. So we this is one of those. Anyway, so what we decided to do is to have our cultural awareness symposium outside, and it was from, what did you say, from St. Luke's?
Yeah, I guess
it
was. Right
across the street from where we're doing this interview, literally. And we had, and so at that cultural program, we had gotten some of the international professors here at Swanee to donate outfits so that the black women students here could do an international fashion show. Mm-hmm. So Dr. Elwood Dunn, who's from Liberia, his wife from Liberia, donated clothes from Liberia. There was another sister here from India who donated clothes. And so the African-American women students wore their clothes. And stuff. So we had an African dance, international fashion show we had a, there was an African dance troupe in Nashville that we found out about, a youth African dance troupe. Mm-hmm. They had about 30, 40 young people in the troupe. It was a huge troupe, and they came down and performed. They were all part of the, you know, so we had like a whole outdoor festival basically scheduled. Yeah. With speakers, poets, people performing. Right. And but the highlight was the fashion show and the African dance troupe. And we had the food service to serve food out there. Mm-hmm. Where we did it. So it forced the students to come by at least, right, to get lunch.
Exactly.
They had to come out to all of the Swanee community, had to come out to our cultural awareness symposium to get their lunch that day. There was no lunch served in Gale Hall that day. It was served right out there. So that was another one of the things that we brought to the table. And I guess another one while we're on that note would be, we started the first celebrations of Martin Luther King Day here. Right. We started something called the Martin Luther King Day Candlelight Vigil.
That's correct.
And so we would have it in the evening, and we would read excerpts from Martin Luther King, mm-hmm, speeches. And one of the things that I guess we felt that we kind of were validated in a sense is because the Joe Wiegand, who was a European American student, president of the student body, he came and spoke at our Martin Luther King, mm-hmm, Day. You wanted to add something to
that? Yeah, the initial Martin Luther King event took place, like I said, it was a march, and then it ended right on the corner steps of the chapel that faced Gaylor. At that time, I set up a recording where we played a speech of Martin Luther King, a short speech. And then we had Eric Walden come and sing, Lift Every Voice, lead us and lift every voice and sing, remember that? Mm-hmm. And then everybody's standing with their candle lit. And then I was at the time was the vice president of the BSU, Black Student Union. Miss Eugenia Williams was the president. But the organization of that fell on my shoulders. And man, it turned out to be such a wonderful event, well received by the community, that it took root. And it, as I understand it, it still continues. But yeah, I just want to add that a little bit too. It was a great thing.
Yeah, one of the things too, I was doing some reflection on, you know, and I didn't think about this way while we were here, but I thought, when we were here, particularly in Swanee, but I realized that later on, you know, Everett talked about the importance of music and culture and art. And I realized that, you know, more than us being DJs was the fact that we bought our albums, because I inherited my mom's collection. And so music was really therapy for us.
It was
therapy for me, I know for sure, as one way of dealing with life in Swanee. Because there's no cultural stuff, there's no anything to reflect African-American history, right, or culture. And so other than, you know, us having conversations with each other, you know, every so often us having parties or whatever. So, you know, and my mother had what I consider a very expansive record collection, mm-hmm, you know, so I was listening to stuff like Gil Scott-Heron. I'm listening to Fela music that, you know, my mother introduced me to. I'm listening to Sweet Honey and the Rock. Mm-hmm. I'm listening to Stevie Wonder,
right,
you know. And even, I'll share this story. I was thinking, because this story is always funny to me.
I know what you're about to say.
You don't know what I'm about to say.
I guarantee you I do, but go ahead and tell it.
This story is always funny to me because during the holiday breaks, mm-hmm, sometimes I
know exactly.
You know, I was going to.
You should have talked about what's his name came and knocked on our door when he had heard the music. But go ahead.
No.
Okay.
Okay,
I said it correctly.
So, the story I was going to tell is that, so during the holiday breaks, Thanksgiving, Christmas breaks, sometimes I would go to Atlanta, but sometimes I would go to D.C. where my dad lived, and sometimes I would go to New York where I had cousins and family. So one break, I don't remember what it was, Christmas, Thanksgiving break, whatever, I went to New York, and hip-hop was just really coming out at that time. And I got this, and so, you know, I thought it was cool that I'm getting the latest music, because at that time when music came out, it started in New York. Right. It wasn't like a song came out and it was all over the United States. Music started in New York, particularly hip hop, and then it's later, you know, trickled down to the rest of the country, right? And so I was in New York, so I was able to get the latest, hottest music. So I bought this album, Dougie Fresh 6 Minutes. And I bought it back. And so I was all excited, man. This is the jam. This is the hottest song. This is it. So I played it to my tune. They all looking at me like I'm crazy. I done lost my mind. They're like, we are not going to play that. Where you get that, bro? What was that? They dug me out so bad. I was disappointed.
I stand apologetic to you now for help.
No problem. But yeah, eventually, Dougie Fresh caught on. This hip hop caught on. And they realized that that was a hit. Another side on that. That was the same time I believe I bought Michael Jackson Thriller. That album just came out. $5.99 Tower Records. I still remember that. And we didn't even have any idea, any clue that that album was going to be
as big as
it was.
But it became big.
Every song on there was a hit.
Yeah, we had a great
time. And I remember also because I was thinking about a way to try to bring some of the women into this, but I don't know if this is the best story, but I remember, you know, when Michael Jackson's videos were going to be released, that was a big deal. Mm-hmm. Like, we heard he's going to release Beat It.
Mm-hmm. So
Billie Jean. And so, particularly the sisters would gather somewhere in one of the common areas, and everybody stopped everything. Michael Jackson, new video just let it drop. That was a big Thriller. Thriller, Beat It, Billie Jean, those were phenomenal videos. Like, those were cutting edge videos. And so we were like, Michael Jackson, new video about to be released today. Stop homework, stop everything. We meet at so and so dorm. And one more funny story about the music, right? Cleavis, we were in Atlanta this time shopping for new music.
Right.
We can't buy no music up here. We gotta get the latest music. We DJ. We gotta go to Atlanta, New York, DC. So we were in Atlanta this time shopping for some music, right? And I'll never forget, Cleavis Headley, who was a part of Mun 2, he picked up an album with Whitney Houston on it. Mm. And this is her first album. Right. Little skinny, she's real skinny on that album. And he's like, oh, this cheese is beautiful, man. We should get this album. I'm like, man, we ain't gonna buy an album because the chick look cute on the album. He said, yeah, man, she looks good, man. We should get this album. We're gonna buy an album because of the cover. So, but then he got me though. What he did was, back in those days, when you go to the record store, they have a list of the top 20 hits or the most popular songs.
Right.
She had two songs that was in the top 20. I said, okay, you got it. Let's get it. Of course, Whitney Houston's first album was a big success, and you know, I apologize to him. He's like, hey, you were right. She was beautiful, and she had a great album, and she could sing. Those are some. So yeah, but music was a very big part of, I think, to me, feeling comfortable.
Can I interject something?
Sure, go ahead.
Man, so as a geopolitical conscious raising artist in music, my meeting here at Swanee brought me to see Bob Marley, man, and the in-depth lyrics and social consciousness and political consciousness of Bob Marley and the Wailers and their reggae music, and it expanded from there, man. I still love reggae music to this day. Prior to coming to Swanee, I had an enlightened music collection that included Earth, Wind, and Fire as my, like, my ultimate group that had consciousness. You know, you keep your head to the sky. Those types of
fire. My mom was big on.
Okay, so now with Earth, Wind, and Fire, now comes this gentleman who's in the Caribbean playing this music, you know, redemption song and some more powerful lyrics, you know. That I still listen to this day, that just empowers me, and it's still relevant, you know, to our day, I think, in my opinion. And I'm so thankful that it wasn't Swanee that introduced me to him. I think more so our social interaction. I got to give credit to Eric Benjamin, because he just played a couple of Bob Marley songs. You know, everybody knows songs like Three Little Birds, Jam, and that kind of thing. Even Stevie Wonder did a rendition to represent Bob Marley called Jam. And then that led to an exploration in my mind of further seeking out reggae music. And man, my reggae music collection just grew. And
my favorite group back then was Third World.
Yeah.
Third World had a little bit
more commercial.
Yeah.
But I'm saying, and so that's how those one, you know, I would say just the entry point for a lot of people with reggae was Bob Marley or Third World, you know, because of their music was, you know. But I'm saying we played a lot of it. We played some of their music as DJs, Third World.
Exactly.
Music, and I love Third World.
Third World was a little bit more dance.
Very conscious. Yeah, but their lyrics are very conscious.
Conscious as well.
Very conscious lyrics as well. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so I had a whole page full of notes. I'm trying to see what I haven't talked about that I wanted, what I haven't talked about yet on here. What's that?
March.
Oh, wow. Oh, man. Okay.
You can't leave that out.
I can't leave that out.
You can't leave that out.
I can't leave that one out. And I got receipts. Damn. Crazy pulls out a file folder with Browning articles hanging out the edge.
From what newspapers?
We're gonna do it.
Okay,
We're gonna do it. Yeah, maybe this would be a good note to end on because there's more stuff we can talk about. But so yeah, there was at one point Suwani launched a campaign to raise $50 million, and they thought it was going to take 7 to 10 years, but they did it in 3 years.
Right.
The last couple of campaigns I heard they raised 170, 190.
It's up there now, boy.
So that was nothing.
I thought the last one was 255.
Okay, could be. So let's just stick with let's stick with the 80s when they raised they raised $50 million in three years, and for the endowment. And so they decided that what they were going to do was have Vice President Bush to receive an honorary degree at convocation and celebration of this accomplishment of raising this money. Mm-hmm. So Dr. Elwood Dunn, our professor from Liberia, who was my mentor here at Suwannee, some other conversations we could have, someone that helped to help us to navigate being here and feel comfortable here. He also had parties at his house.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Matter of fact, I had a story, one specific story about that, but anyway, so Dr. Elwood Dunn kind of never said directly, but he hinted very clearly about, you know, perhaps there should be some type of response to Bush coming to Suwannee. And so we decided to, I initiated the idea of us having a march, a protest. You know, so we started having conversations with what we thought were the most progressive organizations at Suwannee at this time, and professor, and there was a little crew, I don't know how to represent it, but it was a little crew of progressive professors, we could call them,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. That had gone to Berkeley, were active in the civil rights movement, right. According to them.
That's correct.
And they had an organization called the Suwannee Peace Alliance. So we went to them and said, no, we don't want to have a march. We don't want to support that. We went to the National Organization of Women, which was also very progressive,
right.
Liberal here on campus. Went to several other organizations. And all of them said they didn't want to support having a march. Then the word got out that we were having this. So Vice Chancellor Ayers invited us to have a meeting with him. And we sat down at a round table. And he said that he would guarantee that we could have a meeting with him to air our concerns, a private meeting with Vice President Bush. And we thought about it for a minute.
Just for a second.
And then we decided that we said to him, our response to him was that us doing the march is not for us alone, it's for the Suwannee community.
Now, I want you to clarify something when you say we. Who are the we you talking about?
We is Muntu.
There you go.
We is Muntu. Thank you. We is Muntu. We kind of defined Muntu earlier.
Right.
So Muntu, let's be real, real clear. Muntu, Clevis Headley from Barbados, the only African-American student before Betty Arnold, before Benjamin Rick started recruiting. Then Everett and Eric, Eric Wald and Everett McQuarrie, myself, and Carrie Sinclair, the five of us.
That's right.
So we were organizing to have this march in Bush come, hoping that we could get some other people to join us besides the five of us.
That's right.
And even at one point, some of the professors, progressive professors, at one point did say that they would support the, but yeah, we told Dali. I pointed out we told Vice Chancellor no,
right,
right, And so some of the progressive professors did say that they would join with us. And then one of the professors, I do have the names and stuff, but anyway, one of the professors and his wife changed their minds that they're not going to come. Mm-hmm. And then one of the other professors, who their peers, told them, you know, said they sent a letter, a formal letter to us, saying that they would change their mind. They didn't think that the march would have the right impact that we wanted to have, blah, blah, blah. And then another couple, Dr. Goldberg and his wife,
that's correct,
responded to their letter, their peers, like I said, progressive professors. And he said, you know, basically said, don't wimp out. You know, y'all need to support the march, you know, basically, mm-hmm. to paraphrase it. And but I have copies of those letters as well. We're going to enter them into the record, into the Swanee record. We got copies of both of the letters.
That's true.
And so we went ahead with the march. And
found much wider support.
And found much wider support than we realized. One of the groups that brought a big contingency, we had no idea of, it was the
School of Theology.
No. The convent. St. Mary's Convent came with placards and came, like, I don't know, 20, 25 nuns came to support the march. We did a count of about 125 people total. We had the march. We put an announcement out to everybody. We put it to all the students. We put it in the SPO. Y'all still call it SPO?
Yeah.
The SPO, for those who are not Sewanee, is the news. The mail, the student post office. Thank you.
Swanee student post office.
Thank you. Swanee student post office. And we put a letter out to everybody to clear up the rumors. We called it to clear up the rumors. We organized the march to be very well disciplined. We told people that we were going to have marshals to keep everybody. It was going to be a silent vigil. First of all, it's going to be a silent vigil. We're not going to be chanting or anything. It's going to be, we're going to have spokespersons. So if the press shows up, we know the press is going to show up because Vice President's coming. Mm-hmm. So, but we're going to have designated spokesperson, so they don't can't talk to anybody. We have designated spokesperson. We have designated marshals who make sure that we, you know, are safe and everything. We had safety concerns taken care of, all of that. And we organized it. And then we came up with a position statement. And I was proud of the position statement because what we did with the position statement is that we looked at the resolutions that were passed by the Episcopal Church. Every 2 years there's a convening, I forgot what it's called, biannual something, they call it convening, whatever it is, it's a convening that the Episcopal Diocese has every 2 years. It's a big, big deal. And we pulled position statements from that to say, this is why we're in opposition, you know, what the administration that Bush represents, as he's coming as an Episcopalian. Well, if he's coming as an Episcopalian, these are the things that, and Swanee being an Episcopalian school, these are the things that Episcopalians are saying that we are for or against, and that's in contrary to what this government is doing. Mm-hmm. And so Swanee bringing him, this is a conflict. So we laid out a position statement. We talked about what was going on at that time, the Nicaragua situation, mm-hmm. Contras in Nicaragua, South Africa was a big issue at that time. We talked about other things, just personal concerns, like, you know, more funding for Black students, in general government funding for, you know, grants and stuff for Black students. I think we had some stuff in there around women and discrimination. Mm-hmm. Well, again, we have those documents too. So
and then I just add this little tidbit, because we, being here at Swanee at the time while we were students, we were isolated from our communities back home.
Mm-hmm.
So when I went home for summer, I came to find some of our communities in Atlanta ravaged with crack cocaine,
mm-hmm.
which was a onset that was developed during that administrative period. Mm-hmm. And so I had friends of mine who were in high school who mentioned something that I had no idea. And I was like, what are you talking about? And he told me, literally, he said, man, you've been isolated on that mountain for so long that you don't know what's going on here in our community. And so once he educated me on that, I was able to make that connection. And then sometime later, we have something called the Iran-Contra affair that brings a whole lot of this stuff to light. So, yeah.
So also one of the things that happened with the march was that the professors were basically, I assume, say, were threatened basically with attending convocation by the vice chancellor. They were, and so, and maybe perhaps some that didn't have tenure were concerned about, you know, going to the protest versus going to convocation. However, what happened, and this was a very critical part of the march, was that the vice president was said in his speech something to the effect, and we had the exact quote because it was quoted several times in the newspapers. Basically, he said in his speech that somebody asked me about the protesters outside, but I would have been disappointed if they didn't show up.
Mm.
And so that validated the march. And so some of those professors, and they honored their obligation by going to convocation, but then they left convocation and came and joined the march. Mm. Yeah. And so, again, we have, I have articles here from, first of all, the Suwannee Purple. There were several articles in the Suwannee Purple, as well as opinions about the march, mostly favorable. And then we had articles from the Suwannee Purple. We have articles from the Chattanooga Times. And we have articles from the Nashville Tennessean. And all of this is covering Bush's visit here. Yeah, that's the Chattanooga Times again. Yeah, so we have the articles where they reference the march. There's some quotes in there by me as a spokesperson of the march. Mm-hmm. And like I said, all of the articles reference the fact that Bush validated us in his speech, which validated the march. We have pictures from the march. There's actually pictures of the march, not only in the Suwannee Purple, but in a couple of the yearbooks.
Mm-hmm.
There's pictures from the march as well in some of the Suwannee yearbooks. So, am I leaving at?
No, you're good. I was thinking maybe you wanted to read one of the
read a portion.
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be cool to give a context for what you're talking about.
So this comes from the Chattanooga Times, dated Monday, October 7th, 1985. And the march was conceived by Hobart James Jr. of Atlanta, a senior studying economics and third world studies. The young black man's lapel boy button supporting the Southwest African People's Organization. Quote, most people thought we were doing the school a disservice. They said this is not a political event, that it is a university academic function, unquote, James said. Quote, they said this is an embarrassment to the university or it's not in the Suwannee tradition. But the school is noted for bringing controversial people to campus. We are here to enlighten the Suwannee community to engage in dialogue, unquote. So that was a section from me.
I think that's so important considering our current political environment where people are so divisive in our current atmosphere that we were able to find a means of being entering into a dialogue with different opposing positions, mm-hmm. and still being civil and exercising civility. And that's one of the reasons why I thought it would be important to read that,
mm-hmm.
so you can compare what happened back then and give it a context to what's going on now.
Mm-hmm. All these questions by protesters, mm-hmm.
and
indigenous
one
of
purple,
yeah,
that was good.
Yeah, the one that you always claim was the best one in the purple.
October 11th, 1985.
Okay, this is Lakeman defends protesters. This is like, I guess, an opinion piece that was in the Suwannee Purple. I'm trying to figure out where's a good section to read. I hope no one questioned our right to protest Mr. Bush's administration's policy. Certainly he did not. In his address, he defended the right of church members to fight with their sleeves rolled up, quote, for their political beliefs. Our group did not acknowledge any particular religious affiliation. Nonetheless, those of us who are fellow Episcopalians were glad to see the vice president agree with us on this fundamental point. I also hope that no one felt embarrassed for Mr. Bush. Certainly he did not. He himself said that something would have been seriously wrong if he himself said that something would have seriously wrong if no one here have protested his policies. It is unfortunate that he at least understands the vital role that debate and public dialogue may play in American politics. I am also glad to see that Mr. Bush understands that it is possible for us to welcome his presence and disagree with his policies at the same time. Mm-hmm. And then he's saying this in the third person, so he must have participated with us.
He
participated with us in the march.
Yeah, he's saying this.
So this was, his name is Thomas Lakeman.
Thomas Lakeman, yeah, Thomas.
That's, again, an excerpt from him. And there's several, actually there's several opinion pieces that were in the Suwannee Purple, as well as an article about the march,
right,
as well as opinion pieces about the march, and as well as pictures from the march as well.
So sort of a synergy happened, mm-hmm, so to speak. So I had done my intern at the
Harold
King,
right,
Center for Nonviolent Social Change, which we literally studied the principles of nonviolent social change. You had done an intern.
I had an internship at TransAfrica Forum, which, mm-hmm, is a leading public policy organization of African Americans focusing on public policy towards Africa and the Caribbean. And again, this was all through the fellowship that Suwannee offered students. And actually, while I was there, while Everett was name dropping, I got a chance to be in a room with people like Desmond Tutu, Harry Belafonte, leaders of the South African Trade Union Organization, different high-level people like Jesse Jackson and other elected officials, Congress people in D.C. came through the office, so we were able to, see them, at least introduce ourselves to those types of people. And that was a very exciting summer for me to do work with TransAfrica. Like I said, at the time, the Free South Africa movement was very big. That was a time when, mm-hmm, there was people who got arrested every day, right, in front of the South African embassy for a whole year. And so TransAfrica Forum was the organization that organized that. So they would go into church groups and different groups to pick a day out of the week to organize. I got arrested myself. I think it was one day a group didn't come. They're like, we need somebody to get arrested today. Grab that intern, Holbert.
Put him on the front line.
because the rule was, this is how the strategy came about, was that the leader of TransAfrica Forum and two other activists, I wish I could remember their names right now, but anyway, two other well-known black activists in D.C. Protested in front of the South African embassy. And the South African embassy said, we won't press charges if you just don't do it again. So they got the idea, we'll just get some other organizations and other people and other church groups to protest. And so they launched this campaign of people protesting every day. And I learned about this, again, like I said, one of my breaks from school. My dad is an activist. And so I was on break from Suwannee, I think, again, Thanksgiving or Christmas break with my dad, is when I learned about this going on in TransAfrica. And so I got a fellowship, mm-hmm, through Suwannee to be an intern with TransAfrica, which was very, just like Everett said, was very, it's kind of like a life-changing event to have that opportunity.
Right. Great. Yeah. See, all those great memories, right?
Yeah. So you were saying about how you had gotten training.
Right. So part of the training of the nonviolent, or the reflect at the Center for Nonviolent Social Change, Martin Luther King Center for Nonviolent Social Change, was that we literally studied the philosophy
nonviolent direct action.
Exactly. And
some people need about the direct action
part. What it meant
part.
To be placed in an environment where your life could be threatened. What type of training those students at SNCC and all those other organizations had when they were in what we quote unquote now call the movement from the 60s. And now we're a generation, two generations behind that. We're in the 80s. And so we're still studying because we understand that there's still work to be done. Not that we want to be confrontational just to be confrontational, but we wanted to be push the idea of black people being who they are and finding liberty and freedom in the context by which they find themselves. We're only one generation from being lost in mind. I mean, every generation has to learn these same lessons, so to speak, and hopefully we as those who've been through it can pass them down, and hopefully the generation who will pass them down to can listen and hear and follow. But yeah, we learned those things, and so during that time of the march, we came up with the idea of having armbands to identify our marshals so we could protect. And the idea of marshals, because we didn't know what kind of response would happen here on the mountain. This was a very peaceful environment for the most part. We could walk around campus, enter any dorm at any time of the night, almost from that, you know, freely. And so we had much more of a free idea of being able to move in and about, but we had no idea what kind of response would happen to even the communities beyond Suwannee, because they would have heard about them coming, what kind of response. And so we wanted to be prepared to protect anyone who was a part of participating in that process.
And I think it's important, you know, I don't know if we can figure out how we can get a student to do some research on this. We may have had the only march like this in Suwannee. At least that's what we were told up until the point we had. And I don't know if there's been anything subsequent to it, but that was one of the big things that Suwannee was wrestling with. Mm-hmm. Students, faculty, everybody was like, this is not what we do. This is not characteristic of Suwannee. We don't do that. That's those other colleges that do that. But that's not the Suwannee protocol. That's not the Suwannee ethic. That's not the Suwannee ethos to have a protest, mm-hmm. period. And so we were going up against all of that. Mm-hmm. We were going up against
trying to carve out a place. A place where we could feel.
So I would be interested to see if anything is, if they ever, the impression I get, it hadn't been one before us. Mm-hmm. We don't know that for sure, but that was the impression we were given. And I don't know if there's ever been one after that one, which we could, that one, that should be easier to research if there was, you know, if there's been any protests since 1985. But now before 1985, that might be a little bit more challenging to research.
Right.
But then, I think that would be a good endeavor. You know, we made history.
Sure.
Whether there was other ones or not, this one did make history.
You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
Now, so, I must say that
you gotta go.
Yeah, I've got to. If you want to continue, you're welcome to. You got so much vast. There's so much more we could go on for days.
More things we could talk about. We talked about mostly everything I see on my list.
All right. Well, cool.
But that's significant.
Yeah.
You already, and I was going to say we need to talk about the locks on the doors and all that, but you just mentioned it.
We could go on.
Yeah, there's other little stories we can tell, but I think we told the significant ones. I think the significant stories and the significant perspective that we bring to this conversation, I think we got across.
I think you're absolutely right.
Thank
you for having us. We don't know what they're going to do with this, but hey, we look forward to seeing what happens. I'm looking forward to you sharing all your documents because I'm sure they'll be archived, you know, because you have literal physical evidence to back up what we're talking about.
Pictures, letters, articles. And actually, one last little note, I was teasing Everett when we walked over here. One of the creative, I don't know who came up with this idea, we think Eric Walden did. One of the little fundraiser ideas we came up with was singing Valentine's.
Oh yeah, that's Eric. That's Eric.
So we decided as African American students, we would take different songs and rework them, like, or at least the refrain of different songs. We worked them into little Valentine's sing jingles, and offer that to students to give a Valentine song serenade to their. Significant other, friend, girlfriend, potential, whatever. Right. And so that's what we did. We had a whole little system. We would go to one dorm, then the next dorm. We would to go to this room and blah, 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 knock on the door. We would, they would tell us what song they wanted us to sing. And we would pick a song and we would sing a song to them. I thought that was just a little unique.
Yeah, I thought that was good. We always thought kind of outside of the box, right?
So, but I think we covered a lot of ground, man.
This is a project that's ongoing, isn't it? This recording.
Yeah,
we may come up with a whole bunch of more. And then there's some other, some other students.
There's some other students you
are. They're going to bring their perspective. Yeah.
That's right. And I do look forward to entering this stuff, some of my documents and pictures into the official record.
That's like you had the foresight to say all this stuff like that. They're
gonna
love all this.
That's the kind of guy he is. I have a little bit, but you have a lot.
Yeah. I was saving my test and papers for a long time. I think I got rid of it at some point, though.
Is that right?
I have to go back and look, though. I might still have.
That's good. That's awesome. Does this end our session?
This ends our session. I think that's a good note to end our session. Is there a question or anything?
Yeah, you want to ask us?
We just talked like we did.
Let me think. I think that's it.
I'm cool. I'm all right, but I got a little time.
What would you like to know from someone that's, well, you're about to graduate anyway, so it's not like she's anybody's advice we need for the next 2 months. What would you like to have heard before you came to Swan that could have better prepared you? I'll say this. One thing that I learned is, and I think Cletus mentioned this to us. He said one of the things that they don't, that colleges usually don't talk about before you go to college, your experience at a college campus is fundamentally influenced by who your roommate is. Mm. It has a big impact. HBCU, PWI, it doesn't even matter. Who you first come and end up staying with as a roommate has a lot to do with your experience as a student.
Yeah, absolutely right.
Yeah, that was something that he said. And I thought that was true. Like, when I went back to, like, talk to high school students, that's something I added in my little presentation. Mm-hmm. Like, that's something to think about. And the other thing, you know, I think about is that colleges, when they're recruiting, and they don't talk about social life that much. And, you know, they want to underplay that. But, you know, you're in your... You know, you're 18, 19, 20, 21. Social life is a big part of being a college student. Like, it's, you know, it is. Like, we didn't talk about party weekend, but, you know, but social life is a big part of any college experience. Again, whether it's an HBCU, whether, you know, it's a PWI,
right.
Period, it's a big part. And no one really talks about that. It's just like, you know. And I think that those are things that high school students, you know, that should be a part of the conversation we have with high school students. And we should keep it real with them. You know, it's going to be party. People are going to be, you know, I was telling everyone we walk here, party weekend, you stepping over people going to your door the next day. People are drunk and passed out on the floor.
But after studying hard, you need that big release. So we enjoy it, right?
Yeah.
We had a good time.
So we let you off the hook unless you got something.
Was your final impression of Sewanee? Like, how do you look back on it?
Well, that's complicated.
It is.
So for us, at least for me, and I know for at least I don't want to speak for Eric's, but we've talked about it. There seems to be at some point a soul reckoning with Sewanee, because when you leave here, you have a sort of a. But you have a love relationship that also is complicated. I think that's probably the best way to put it. And then when you meet your your peers who went to other colleges and universities, and you find out their experiences, and you say to yourself, like, you got accepted Morehouse. I got accepted Morehouse. I was going to go there and have a relationship with them, but events turned. But when you find that out and you hear those stories, and then you say, and you reflect on what could have been, then at some point your soul has to reconcile and say, this is the place by which God wanted me to be in his divine providence. And that's the way I reconcile it. And so, you know, it's good to see old classmates. It's good to reminisce, and I love it. And I have a great relationship with my university. And I say that, you know, at least in my mind. On my terms.
I was thinking the answer for me, and it's interesting because it took me back to what I said in the very beginning of the interview, which I look at it as I passed the test that my elders gave me. Because, you know, there was a big attrition. I don't know what it's like now. Attrition meaning that many African American students, particularly in our era, dropped out, didn't graduate. You know, probably more dropped out than or transferred, more, you know, left Sewanee than graduated. You know, versus how many came in. And so, you know, so graduating from Sewanee was important for me, and I think significant. And again, we just talked about all of the things that we did and contributions we made to the school, you know, that would have been, you know, I'm sure different if I had gone to a different school. It's a challenging relationship though, because again, sometimes I do, you know, I reminisce or regret and think about, you know, the fun I would have had if I had gone to Howard, or I think about, you know, the social life I feel like I missed out if I had gone to a school like Morehouse, or, you know, yet, you know, I feel like, you know, there are certain things that I got from Sewanee that was unique and that helped to prepare me in the work that I do, and helped to prepare me, you know, just, it gave me an experience I wouldn't have gotten if I had gone to Morehouse or Howard. So I'm thankful for that. Right. I'm thankful for that.
All right. Well, thank you, young lady, again.
Thank y'all.
And that's meeting, yeah. The posse.
Yeah.
I'm so excited to meet one of you for the posse.
I told them about that. He's like, I got to talk to one of them. He's so excited. And as soon as you said you were from DC, I said, uh-oh. Yeah. He goes, sit you down and take your break.
Thank you.
Thank you, thank you.
I'll see you all.
Yeah, brother.
I see you.
All right. I'm going to get something to eat. Mm-hmm.
And so
we got lunch, though, eh?
Now? Now it's 1:30.
Is it that late?
Yeah.
Oh. So they said we go to jail and show our badge. Mm-hmm. And what's your name again? They want to ask
Brianna.
You. Brianna. Mm-hmm. Okay, Brianna. Okay. Thank you for being patient and listening to two old guys ramble. Oh,
and so concludes this interview session.